CFMU. This is your host here, Sharon, speaking, and today we have a very special episode for you. Today, we have a podcast from the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance, also known as AHA. AHA supports an accessible community so that all persons regardless of disability can self-determine through freedom of choice here in Hamilton and at McMaster. AHA believes in full inclusion for all persons, seniors, and persons with disabilities and taxpayers. The following podcast is part of the first ever Disability History Month in Hamilton and at McMaster, which was just last month, so it's coming out a little bit afterwards, and it is a reflection of McMaster and of a McMaster community leader who has been instrumental in bringing about a change for more accessible community. We here at CFMU are pleased and are excited to be able to show you this wonderful podcast, chatting with Tim Nolan from the AHA. And hope you quite enjoy it. Here coming right up is the Tim Nolan interview, which will take up the entirety of the Morning File slot this morning. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Enya.
Hi, everyone.
And we are here today with Tim Nolan. This interview is part of the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance's, otherwise known as AHA, Disability History Month initiative. We hope this inaugural History Month initiative has been informative, shedding some light on how disability and accessibility have been important to the history of our community here at McMaster and beyond, and how they can be important to the community in years to come. AHA believes strongly that only a fully accessible community can lead to every person having choice and self-determination. And it is only where a community has the freedom of choice that it can truly be richer socially, economically, and physically. After 31 years of service at McMaster, Tim retired in 2020 from the position of Director of Student Accessibility Services. Tim was actively engaged in the provision of academic accommodations to students with disabilities, support to faculty and staff on disability-related matters, and changing landscape of accessibility within and across programs on the physical campus. Tim has been equally engaged across the city of Hamilton and the province of Ontario in support of all persons with disabilities and the broader community. He's the inspiration behind the establishment of the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance and the newly initiated Disability History Month and the Hamilton Accessibility Film Festival, or the Halftime Show. Now, there is more, but let's get started with the questions. I will pass it off to Enya.
Thank you, Katarina. And again, welcome, Tim. We are really excited to come and interview you today. You've done lots of stuff, and so really excited to come just delve into the specifics. So the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance, or AHA for short, strong believes that it only full accessibility can lead to self-determination through choice, as Katarina mentioned earlier. And so if the environment is really accessible, then people with disabilities will have the opportunity to exercise their choice for participation, whatever form that may take. And what do you think about this belief?
Accessibility really gives people the freedom to choose. So, you know, any person who wants to find a job, I mean, you know, with perhaps a few exceptions, generally speaking, people are not restricted in the kinds of things they might want to pursue in terms of employment. Same thing goes for where they want to go and shop, or where they want to go for entertainment or recreation or whatever. That's not necessarily true for people with disabilities. There's a good number of people with disabilities who are more than qualified academically, that is, or otherwise, to pursue employment. But not all job places are physically accessible. Not all job places are socially accessible. Not all workplaces pursue employment of people with disabilities. The same thing goes true with entertainment. Case in point, this coming Sunday, September 15th, we're going to be hosting the first ever Hamilton Accessibility Film Festival. A great deal of effort has gone into ensuring that all four films we're going to show have open captioning. But regrettably, only two of the four films have open description, which means the films will be described for the audience, describing what's actually going on screen at any point in time. So, you know, not everybody has the ability to access all of their environment all of the time. So part of the goal of AHA is to bring attention and awareness to these issues so that hopefully people in the broader community will be engaged in the importance of accessibility and pursue full accessibility for all persons down the road. Hopefully, perhaps even having conversations with their elected officials or demanding that elected officials take a very strong position on ensuring that the environment is fully accessible to everybody all of the time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And kind of moving on to the next question here, a little bit more related as well. In 2005, the Ontario government legislated through the AODA full accessibility by 2025, so next year. Do you think Ontario will be there by January 1st, 2025? And what do you think the government or society generally ought to do to move accessibility forward?
Yeah, I don't see 2025 be, you know, all of a sudden the community being fully accessible. Perhaps much to the chagrin of many of my colleagues, in 2005, I thought that a 20-year goal was rather ambitious. We have more than 200 years of catch up to make, and I don't know how you can catch up in 20 years what has been built and designed as inaccessible for the previous 200 years or more. Additionally, we have to change mindset, and not everybody thinks about accessibility, and it's not part of their consciousness. So how do we bring accessibility into the consciousness of people? So I really thought that 20 years was a bit ambitious, and I personally would have liked to have seen a bit of a slower move and a more gradual move. Very few people like to be told what to do, but I think when people come to realize things, perhaps in some cases on their own or through their experience, then they're more likely to be more accommodating in terms of their inclusive perspectives or attitudes. So, and without getting into lots of detail, changing consciousness among people, it will take more than just a generation. So, I don't think we'll be accessible by 2025. And what can we do? Well, I've been asking that question of government leaders. I've been asking that question of bureaucratic leaders, and I've been asking that question among people in the disability community, and nobody seems to have a good answer, except to say in 2025, of course, all of the accomplishments to date must continue, but there is no more obligation upon the community at large to continue to pursue matters of accessibility beyond the regulations. So I think it's time that the government goes back to the drawing board and asks that question: what can we do, what should we do, and how do we better engage the broader community in order to work towards full accessibility? Because at the end of the day, full accessibility is better for the whole community in many ways, not least of which is economically.
Yeah, that definitely is a big point. You answered our next question too, but if you would like to kind of maybe elaborate a bit more on how do you think people with disabilities, or maybe as generally maybe different communities as well, would be able to get accessibility back into kind of mainstream media, or get, as you mentioned earlier, back into the mainstream consciousness on what it should be kind of right now?
Well, I think through media. And so, you know, hopefully through some of the work that the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance is undertaking, the use of social media like Instagram and Twitter or X, Facebook, other social media platforms, you know, maybe we can bring some of that awareness. Initiatives like the Disability History Month, the Film Festival. I've learned so much about the accessibility of films and the ability to get open accessibility into films from just this very first inaugural Hamilton Accessibility Film Festival. Connecting with people who organize conduct various activities like the Toronto International Film Festival or other things like, you know, Super Crawl in downtown Hamilton or whatever the case may be. I think there's got to be an outreach, and perhaps some of that outreach comes from the broader community at large. So part of the effort for this very first Disability History Month is trying to engage more McMaster University students, and hopefully we can expand upon that next year. Maybe there will be more students involved and student organizations, student groups, and maybe we can expand it into other post-secondary institutions like Mohawk College and Redeemer University, and maybe outreach to school boards to see if we can't connect with students in high school. So, you know, the more we engage people and bring to their attention issues of accessibility, the more likely it is that people will be engaged in these matters going forward. So I think that's, you know, that's part of the goal of the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance. We want people to have what we call an aha moment. And so if we can bring more of those aha moments to the attention of people, then maybe we can shift the needle or move the needle, if I could put it that way, on a more accessible community.
Definitely. I really like the aha moment. When you mentioned it in our previous meetings as well, I always love that kind of statement. And just to add on to, I think one of the things just personally I learned a lot from and I was very excited about kind of within the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance kind of initiative was the amount of community and kind of new relationships that are being built across these different like communities. Like how you mentioned, McMaster, we're reaching out to Redeemer, we're reaching out to Mohawk, we're reaching out to all these various kind of organizations throughout Hamilton and, you know, in the future beyond as well. And there's just so much potential for so many new relations there and so many kind of like-minded people just come together for a common cause, such as important as this one. And, you know, historically, accessibility existed only through accommodation of a single person or an individual following the introduction of the legislation, the ODA and AODA. There was a shift toward accessibility for everyone with a disability collectively. However, in many ways, accommodation seems to again become the norm for replacement of the need for accessibility. And how does society get beyond the idea that accommodation is the way to go? And how does the disability community get the message out that accommodation only is more costly and does little to advance the interests of society at large?
Yeah. You know, when I look at the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, which is broken down into various sections, various categories or classifications, one of which is employment. It's kind of interesting because the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, or what we commonly refer to as the AODA, is all about accessibility. And, you know, the name is obvious in that regard. But the regulations around employment are all about obligations of organizations to actually provide accommodations to employees. So there's very few specific regulations in the employment regulations under the AODA that deal with the changing landscape, the environment, and ensuring that the environment is accessible to employees. Of course, there are other regulations around information and communication, technologies, use of technologies, and compliance with regulations around, or guidelines around accessible websites and so on. But, notwithstanding the accessibility of those platforms, there's also the usability of those platforms. I was recently a member of a Canadian Standards Association review of point of sale, the accessibility of point of sale equipment, like the machines where you pay, with your credit card or your debit cards or whatever, electronic and including accessible ATMs, bank machines. And while there's an agreement that we have to try to find ways to make those accessible, the two issues are they're not accessible today. And the second thing is the standards are only guidelines. They're not requirements. So employers, or retailers are not required to provide accessible point of sale equipment for customers with disabilities. So, until we start changing these things and we stop having to accommodate people on an individual basis, and we give them the freedom to choose to use whatever it is they need in order to be able to access their environment, we're going to continue down this pathway of having to accommodate somebody on an individual basis. And while that may work in many ways, it's not necessarily the right solution. Because not always, it's not always that anybody or everybody can be accommodated in every moment. So, case in point, I go into a store that has a person working at a cash register, or they've got self-checkout. Well, they've got one cash register open and they've got, five self-checkout machines. Well, in many instances, I have to stand in line and wait for the assistance at the cash, because I can't use a self-checkout. They're not accessible. And yet there's five empty machines while there's a big lineup waiting for the cash register. And if I go up and ask somebody for assistance at the self-checkout, well, there's nobody there. So how can I, there's no accommodation ability. So I could talk about these things for a long time, but there really is a greater cost when we have to start doing things for people on an individual basis, as opposed to making the environment more accessible to everybody so that they've got freedom of choice.
Definitely. And on that topic too, we're mentioning, especially now and even back then, disability and accessibility has been a topic of public policy for many years. I feel like more so recently, with the expansion of social media and information traveling as fast as it is these days. But for many years, going all the way back to the early 1980s, after disability was a guaranteed right contained in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, has your definition, your personal definition or understanding or view of the term disability over time changed? And if it has changed, how has it?
Well, language is always evolving. So, at one time we used to refer to people with disabilities as the handicapped. And the term handicapped sort of historically came from a perception where disabled people were looking for handouts, somebody who would be begging on a street corner somewhere, and they'd have a their handout with a hat or a cap in hand. And so that's where the word handicap came from. We moved from the term handicap to disability, and we referred in many cases to people as being crippled, like March of Dimes used to be known as the Crippled Children's Association. But we don't use the term crippled anymore. We don't typically use the term handicapped anymore. And we've even started to shift away from the term disability into a more positive term around ability. So language is always evolving, and that's important. But in many ways, people in various disability communities are starting to take back some of the language. So in some instances, people don't mind the word handicapped, or many people who use wheelchairs refer to themselves as crips. So I think the importance of that is, how do we move from a more medicalized model of impairment, where people with disabilities or people with various impairments are not necessarily perceived as in need of support, but are able to be more independent in their thinking, independent in their actions, independent in their opportunities, and how do we move from that more medicalized model into a more social model of accessibility, where the environment is designed in a way that there are few, if any, restrictions upon people with various types of disabilities, whether those be developmental, physical, sensory, cognitive, whatever the case may be, so that people can be more independently or more independently navigate their environment.
And I just wanted to kind of ask a little bit of a, just kind of continue on that train of thought. Do you think that, you mentioned when this community was taking back some of that language, do you think in that sense, is there some sort of empowerment? Do you think that is helping this community kind of shift away from that medical model, as you mentioned, to a more social model? Do you think that there is, merit in doing so?
Yeah, I'm personally not really big on the type of language, as long as that language is not used in a way that is perhaps a bit on the derogatory side, or if somebody refers to a population as being handicapped, I don't necessarily have a problem. I'm not a big fan of the term, but I'm not necessarily opposed to it. But I find it a bit challenging when I hear people use the term handicap in a way that describes it as, we're dependent upon somebody else, and if we don't get what we need, then the handicap is more pronounced. We would put in hearing systems, we do all of these kinds of things, but the regulations around employment are all about obligations of organizations to actually provide sensory, cognitive, whatever the case may be, so that people can be more independently or more independently navigate their environment.
And I just wanted to kind of ask a little bit of a, just kind of continue on that train of thought. Do you think that, you mentioned when this community was taking back some of that language, do you think in that sense, is there some sort of empowerment? Do you think that is helping this community kind of shift away from that medical model, as you mentioned, to a more social model? Do you think that there is, merit in doing so?
Yeah, I'm personally not really big on the type of language, as long as that language is not used in a way that is perhaps a bit on the derogatory side, or somebody refers to a population as being handicapped, I don't necessarily have a problem. I'm not a big fan of the term, but I'm not necessarily opposed to it. But I find it a bit challenging when I hear people use the term handicap in a way that describes it as, you know, we're dependent upon somebody else, and if we don't get what we need, then the handicap is more pronounced. So, you know, I'm not a big fan of how the language is used in some ways that could be a bit more challenging, if I could put it that way. But fundamentally, I'm to me, a rose by any other name is still a rose. So, yeah, I don't know if I've actually answered your question, but.
No, I feel like this is definitely also very kind of, I guess, in a way, subjective to each and every person on just how they would like to interact with people around them, and you know what they're okay with. As you mentioned, like, do you personally like it? Are you okay with it? I think it's really personal in that case, but it's very true that how language is just so crucial and sometimes very important kind of. Representing something, it can be very easily used for or against, I think. And you did mention earlier that is the case.
And isn't language, like, fundamentally, isn't language part of that whole concept of accessibility? It's the freedom to choose. What, you know, how do I want to be, like, you know, do I want somebody to refer to me as being sight impaired, or do I want them to refer to me as being blind, or, you know, am I crippled? Am I, you know, a person using a wheelchair, using the person first language? Like, I think the freedom to choose your language is fundamentally part of what full accessibility is really all about. It's the freedom to choose.
Very good point. And I feel like that, I'm just like kind of going off of that too. I think it's a very important conversation to have too, kind of building a bridge between those who are in the persons with disability as well as the able-bodied community, if I may say it like that. But I think that's a very important kind of connection to build between the two, because as someone who, you know, as I've been working with you, Tim, as well, I've learned so much about kind of how people want to be addressed, and I've learned so much in terms of, you know, how a respectful way to kind of approach that issue and ask them respectfully in order to make sure that I'm able to address them in a way that they are comfortable with. And I feel like being open about this subject is also very important in terms of, you know, Disability History Month as well, and improving accessibility and improving just communication between the two. Do you agree with kind of what I was saying, or am I off?
No, I think you're bang on.
And moving more towards, I guess, the student population, as you were at McMaster for 31 years, as a champion for accessibility at the university and in the community as well, over the years, what recommendation or advice might you give today to disabled university students? And how might that recommendation or advice fit within the theme of Disability History Month? And how can students today learn from, you know, all the events that we're doing in terms of the history of disability in an effort to cut a pathway for others in the future?
Yeah, I think it's one, probably a couple of things. One is to just sort of be aware of your environment. I mean, in a conversation with one of the students involved with the planning of Disability History Month and the film festival, students said to me, you know, I just thought that, you know, all of these features of accessibility around the McMaster campus had just always been there. And I kind of chuckled a little bit and said, well, no, you know, an awful lot of time and effort and, you know, based fundamentally blood, sweat, and tears went into trying to help the campus or convert the campus to become a more physically and by extension, socially and academically accessible environment. And so many of the things that you see today didn't always exist, and they've only been a part of the McMaster community since 1988. And so, you know, how do we engage students, bringing some awareness to the student population about the realities of accessibility and the history of those realities of accessibility, and engaging the students in more conversation, like is what is done through the Impact Initiative in the Faculty of Science, and engaging the students in a way as to how can they continue down that pathway towards accessibility for all students, and fundamentally faculty and staff. It's really, you know, here's something that, you know, is an absolute reality. I'm perhaps most responsible for this, but, you know, in many of the years in which I worked with people at the university around trying to make the campus environment and particularly classrooms more accessible to students with disabilities, the one population that was absent from that was faculty. And so, you know, here we were fixated on making classes accessible to students. And so we would, you know, we would put in ramps to get into a classroom, into a lecture hall. We would put, you know, we would make accessible seating available. We would put in hearing systems. We'd do all of these kinds of things. But, you know, the podium for faculty was never made accessible. So it would be hard for the university to hire a person who uses some kind of mobility device as an instructor, because they'd have nowhere to teach from, because the, you know, the podium level, the platforms, the stages, the whatever, those things were not accessible. So we were so fixated on the classroom, we forgot about teaching. And so, you know, if we're going to focus on anything, we have to focus on the big picture, not the small picture, if I could put it that way. And so how do we engage students who ultimately become tutorial assistants, lab assistants, professors? How do we engage them so that they continue down that pathway when they move forward with their education, to make sure that every aspect of the university community is accessible? So again, I don't know if I've answered your question, but I think that's, you know, a way to engage students.
No, of course. And I guess that kind of also kind of brings back to what you were mentioning about, you know, having that choice, having the option there for everyone to, you know, have that freedom to, you know, make that choice if they want to continue on in this path or choose another path. But again, choice is the biggest reason. I know, you know, throughout this conversation so far, you've definitely explained a lot about, you know, your experiences and, you know, implied like your, and sorry, not implied, but it's very clear that you have such a passion. And wanted you to kind of go into more detail. Like, what was your raison d'etre that brought you to the work of or concept of disability or accessibility in your life or your career? And, you know, what was your motivation that sustained that reason for also being so involved so extensively as well as for so long, you know, as you have?
I think it comes back to when I, for your audience, I am sight impaired. I lost most of my eyesight literally overnight one night when I was 21 years of age. Life changed for me in without notice. And as a result of that, I was the beneficiary of support from a lot of people. So, you know, really that was my rationale. That was my reason. So when the opportunity to work at McMaster came up, I jumped at the chance, and I'm I'm very fortunate in so many ways that I was taken on by the university to work as a coordinator for the disabled back in the late 80s. But in that role, very soon after that role began, I realized that particularly faculty were equally interested in changing the campus environment, accessibility, as they were in accommodation. And in many ways, they were more interested in accessibility because they felt that it would actually be easier for them if they didn't have to accommodate on an individual basis, because there were a lot of students. And interestingly enough, in those days, there was only, you know, about 40 or 50 students, whereas now I understand there are thousands. And so the challenge is, how do we engage people so that they understand that there, you know, and this comes back to the earlier question about the importance of accessibility versus accommodation. Accommodation takes a great deal of time and effort when you're dealing with individuals, whereas accessibility allows people that freedom of choice. So, I was the beneficiary of a lot of support from others in my fundamentally my recovery after losing my eyesight. And I was really hoping that I could provide that same level of support and assistance to others. That was my motivation.
Yeah, and it's very inspiring to hear, as well, as you know, you have been doing so and are continuing to do so through all these new initiatives such as AHA, Disability History Month, you know, the Halftime Show, being a real, you know, a major supporter of all those things. And I know through past conversations with, you know, other faculty as well from different schools, you have been actively involved in, you know, trying to help not just, you know, the master community, the broader community, other, you know, school communities, Mohawk, Adema, and so on and so forth, and continue to build that good relationship and to, you know, continue to spread awareness. And just based on, and we're, you just want to know kind of just to, what are your thoughts on the current accessibility resources available to people in the community? And do you think it's satisfactory, or does more need to be done to kind of push us in that direction?
I think we need to continue to pursue information and bring awareness to people. I've tried to do that through a handful of articles in the Hamilton Bay Observer and, you know, hopefully through other kinds of social media means. I think we just need to continue that push. The more people who know, the more people who potentially become interested, and the more people who become interested, the greater the propensity for change. And that's, you know, and that's not to say that, you know, by saying change, and by the way, you may have noticed, I really avoid using the term improve, because, you know, to use words like change and improve suggests that what we have now is not right or not good. And there are lots of things that have been done over the years that are right and are good. But that doesn't mean we should stop. I think accessibility is an ever-evolving concept. And as the community changes and the needs of the community may change, then we may have to continue to change what we do in terms of accessibility, how we do it in terms of accessibility, and therefore the outcomes. So I think these are important things to keep in our consciousness long term, all the time.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Tim. It was all very insightful, and I'm sure even myself included, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to this podcast, or you know, who are kind of, you know, actively engaged in, you know, Disability History Month, and as the years go on, hopefully, there'll be more awareness being built around it, and I'm very excited to see what the year unfolds. And now I will hand it over to Katarina, who'll ask some more questions about yourself.
Awesome. Thanks, Enya. And thank you, Tim. Just to echo what Enya said, I think it's so important that we get to hear things from someone like you, Tim, who has been such an empowering and strong voice for so many years for so many. So now let's talk about some questions that will help us to get to know you a little bit more. So for more than 30 years, you were a voice in the McMaster community, vouching for many of the accessible structures that we see on McMaster campus and within Hamilton, particularly, from your role as director at SAS and McMaster. So can you tell us a bit about the attitudes you had early on in your career when it came to discussing accessible structures? And do you think that these attitudes have changed near the latter years of your time at McMaster or even today?
I think when I first started out, my mindset was focused on accommodation, and perhaps understandably so, because the total environment was then not as accessible as it is today. So, for example, when I first started, there were many computer labs on campus used for students in both teaching and for schoolwork. So I had a conversation with somebody, I won't say who, about the importance of putting accessible computing equipment in the lab. And I was told, we don't do that here. If you want accessible computing equipment in labs, you make it accessible, like you buy it, you run the equipment. I knew nothing about, the computing labs, and I don't think that would have been feasible or even doable. Through my budget, I purchased the equipment, but why should that be the responsibility of the disability services? Students with disabilities were students with disability, were students first. They were disabled second. What if you had an instructor who was disabled, who was then going to pay for accessible computing equipment in the lab if you had an instructor? So accessibility belonged to everybody. So another example, students with disability needed to be accommodated at graduation or convocation. And the obligation became that of the disability services. So fundamentally, it was downloaded to me. The university conducts the convocation. Why were those responsible for convocation not ensuring full accessibility of convocation? And why would the disability services have to pay for that? So, what I realized is immediately in order to ensure that people were not denied access, the disability services needed to pay, or the disability services needed to be engaged in the operational side of the activity, whatever that was. But over time, and a lot of work was, and a lot of discussion was trying to help people across the university understand that a student with a disability or a faculty member with a disability is part of the university. And if you're charged with conducting an operation, whether it be computing, whether it be library services, whether it be convocation or whatever it is, then you're doing that for everybody and not just some. And if you're doing it for some, but not others, then fundamentally, that's what segregation is. And so I think over time, people came to realize that doing this meant doing whatever that is. It needed to be done for all and not just some. So, it wasn't, in many ways, the work was not just about changing the landscape, but it was changing the context, changing the understanding, and that was as equally important. And that's the kind of thing that I'm hoping to do through AHA, trying to help the broader community understand that when we do something, we do it for all, not for some.
Right. And I think it's really interesting to see how your perspective and then the perspective of people that you've also worked with has kind of evolved. I think it's an important thing for people to remember that change is not instant, and often it takes a lot of learning and reshaping your thinking. So sort of in that same vein, what advice might you give to students who would like to get involved in advocating for fuller accessibility at the university or in Hamilton and beyond that?
I think, you know, probably a little bit of the same in the previous response, engaging students in the process and helping to shape thinking. If I could, I don't even want to say, use the phrase shape thinking, bringing about an awareness of a different way of thinking around things. Again, kind of similar to how the use of language is so important, but the use of language can be accessible unto itself. The use of language can be uplifting. You own that. And so when people become aware and they become engaged and they realize that their efforts and their thinking helps to shape the environment in so many ways, you know, allows people to feel good about themselves and know that, you know, they've done something that's been beneficial to many other people, regardless of whether those other people know it or not. I've been so engaged on the McMaster campus in years past. I'm very, you know, when I retired, I was very, in many ways, I was very proud of the work that I had done while I was there, because I'd helped to try, in a small way, I had helped to shape a changing landscape of the university. Certainly not by myself, absolutely not by myself. But, you know, I could engage other people to help shape that environment. And so it became a community project of sorts. And that's kind of what I'm hoping to do with the AHA. And by bringing students aboard into the AHA, and I'm very grateful for you and Katarina and Enya and your student colleagues, you know, it becomes a community initiative, and the community is what shapes the change. Not any one of us individually, but all of us collectively. And I think that's what's important. And so how do we engage other students to become agents of change?
Yeah, and I like what you said about the collective, because it's also been really awesome to see how students are otherwise working on the subcommittee for AHA, and the halftime show has kind of grown over the past couple months. And I think a big part of that and a big part of recruitment has sort of been seeing how we are also passionate about it and how we want to empower others. And I think, like, just by leading by example, that already makes a huge impact. I just want to go back to something that you were mentioning earlier, Tim, with regard to language. Did you just want to interject?
No, I was just going to say, you know, when the halftime show is finished and we, you know, we reflect upon what we did and how we did it and start thinking about next year or who can be involved for next year, you know, the people who are going to be in the seats, in the audience, watching those films, they have absolutely no idea about the work that was undertaken by you, Katarina, and Enya, and your student colleagues. But that's okay. You know, they don't necessarily have to know your names, but, you know, I think it helps them, hopefully, to know that this was a collective effort and not without a lot of work and exercise in order to bring the halftime show to the community. And there's some reward in that. And the reward is perhaps generally just, you know, feeling good about yourself because you've really done something for the bigger, broader community.
For sure. And I think it is rewarding to see that you are contributing to that positive change. Moving along, so if we are to agree that sensitivity to disability and accessibility is not inherent in all persons, what approach did you take to nurturing sensitivity toward understanding disability and the importance of accessibility? And what can others do to achieve the same objective? So how can we kind of find that line between not shying away from speaking about it, but also recognizing that we need to be informed with the language that we are using? And, you know, sort of in that realm.
Yeah, I think in a way, it's kind of like pay it forward. I think when the community comes together, it's not an individual that's necessarily paying it forward. It's a collective that pays it forward. And hopefully people feel the reward of the pay it forward concept. And I know it's a big ask, and I know it's a big goal, and it might almost be a bit of a utopian view of society, but one of the things that I'm trying to do through AHA is to take that more positive approach, and perhaps I shouldn't even say a more positive approach, just a positive approach so that people see that change actually matters, and change can be good for the whole community. And you know, one of the things that AHA has promoted is that accessibility is done with seniors, persons with disabilities, and taxpayers in mind. Everything doesn't have to come with a significantly high cost. There are many things that we could do that don't cost a lot of money. You know, so when we're installing new traffic lights at a roadway or an intersection in the city of Hamilton, if we put in audible pedestrian crosswalk signals, then people who are not able to see the green light when it's time to cross the road, if they can get an audible sound, it's a whole lot easier and a whole lot less expensive to install those audible signals when you're installing the traffic lights than it is to go back and retrofit them later on. And if we had more time, I'd give you a ton of examples at McMaster where we could have or should have done things to make the campus more accessible, but the university didn't. And then they had to go back and make changes later on at a much more significant cost. So, you know, I think if we think about accessibility, not just for the community of persons who will benefit from it personally, but for taxpayers and everybody, then I think we'll be much better off.
Absolutely, for sure. All right, Tim, well, it's been so great chatting with you. Before we let you go and wrap it up, I have one more question for you. So in 2022, you established Accessibility Hamilton Alliance. Can you share with us what the current goal is and maybe what long-term goals you might have in mind?
I don't know whether this is doable. It's certainly something I'm going to try to pursue. But I, you know, in order to pursue it, it's something that will absolutely need the involvement of other people who hopefully can have a similar vision. But I'd love to be able to convert the Accessibility Hamilton Alliance to a charitable organization, possibly even a foundation, where the monies that would be realized from that designation can be used for community development to bring about greater awareness. So the Disability History Month and the Film Festival, those are things that really shouldn't cost a ton of money to operate, but that's what, to me, community development is all about. Not just engaging the community in the planning and the organizing, but bringing about a broader awareness to the community about the importance of full accessibility and how that changes lives, how it really changes the lives of other people. And hopefully through the work of AHA, we can engage in more community development initiatives that will give people with disabilities more opportunities to showcase their skills, their talents, their capabilities in a way that enriches the entire community. And without getting into details or other examples, again, I think Disability History Month and the Film Festival are but two ways. And how can we extend that into, you know, that work, perhaps even to a more legislative level, where government is actually realizing in a more positive way the benefits of fuller accessibility in the community?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's been such a great start, and we can't wait to see where things go from here. I'm going to hand it off to Anya to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Tim.
Yeah, and that was great. I really loved sitting in and listening to, you know, what you have to say and, you know, your response to all the questions. Your experiences are just so, you have so many great experiences and so much knowledge just in terms of just on campus at McMaster and within the broader community as well, and being able to talk to so many different kind of groups, you know, be it students, be it faculty, be it counselors, delegating to some council. There's so many things and so many more things that you're doing and been done and you're able to share. And so thank you so much, Tim, for being a part and being such a major support behind, you know, our first ever Disability History Month initiative at McMaster, as well as, you know, Hamilton's first ever Accessibility Film Festival. And your story message is so extremely important and inspirational and motivating to just, you know, so many different groups of people in the community, you know, faculty, students, us, and staff of McMaster and beyond. And I'm sure that in the future, you know, I think in the people, both Katarina and I, we're just so excited to see where AHA and where this entire initiative will take us in so many years to come. And we're just excited to see how, you know, this will also, you know, alter and affect just the accessibility that is available to everyone within the community. Yeah, thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you. And I've had the good fortune to have had the opportunities that I did at McMaster and in the broader community. I've had the good fortune of receiving support from a good many people before and after my work at McMaster, and certainly during. And if it weren't for my very good fortune, I wouldn't have had the opportunity and the pleasure to work with you and Katarina, you, Enya, and Katarina, and all of your student colleagues. That's my good fortune. And I can only hope that these experiences of the Disability History Month planning and the film festival planning, that you will be able to take these things forward throughout your lifetime and draw upon that in your work ahead, wherever that work takes you. And that you can, in turn, try to bring some...
Hey, good morning. Welcome to another edition of The Waiting Room. My name is Lino. I'll be hosting the tunes till 12 noon. We're going to start with some Grobschnitt.